Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, and welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're so glad you're here. One of the central questions from the 2016 election is to what extent it was influenced by Russia. Not if, but how much. And could it happen again? With the midterm elections just a few weeks away, has the citizenry and the country's national security apparatus learned anything? And will we see outcomes once again influenced from far away? Kathleen Hall Jamieson, professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication, argues that no one should underestimate what happened in the run-up to the 2016 election. Not the press, not the population, not the tools, hello Facebook, we're talking to you, that Russia used. Her latest book is Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President, and she joins us now. Welcome to All of It, Kathleen.
It's good to be with you.
So in the cover of your book, there's three questions at the bottom. It says, what we don't, can't, and do know. I'm going to ask you that. What we don't, can't, and do know.
We don't know whether the material generated by the Russian trolls, that is, the imposters pretending they were U.S. citizens marauding about in cyberspace, whether that material reached the vulnerable, susceptible voters who determined the outcome in the three key states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. We do know that their theory of the election was sound. That is, they were doing the kinds of things that candidate Trump needed to mobilize the right voters, evangelicals who were white, conservative Catholics, as well as military households veterans, demobilize those that Trump needed to see turn out at lower levels. That would be African Americans and Sanders supporters. And shift voters where they weren't going to, otherwise were going to vote for Hillary Clinton over to Jill Stein. So their theory of the election was sound. They had material trying to reach the right voters. Largely, their content was shared and distributed, suggesting that at least the visuals were persuasive. But we don't know whether it reached the key voters in the key states.
You also use the word cyber war, and in doing research, I read that you said meddling is just far too benign a word, that these attacks were launched as part of an undeclared cyber war. Why use the word war?
Because you have an intrusion inside a system that had the potential, and I argue probably did, affect electoral outcome in ways that would otherwise be accomplished by other kinds of means. I mean, ordinarily, if you want to change a system of government, you intervene on the outside in ways that are far more direct. And that these sorts of threats to our system, these sorts of intrusions, are sufficiently problematic that the response should be one that is far more serious than the one that we take when we say meddled. If somebody says you meddled, well, the response to meddling is, hey, mind your own business. But you say we were cyber attacked, response is going to be arming oneself, trying to figure out how we defend ourselves and retaliating in ways that ensure that it doesn't happen again. I'm concerned that we're not taking the measures that we ought to take to prevent a recurrence because we're not thinking of this in the terms that require it.
What would be an effective example of defense, and what would be an effective example of retaliation?
Well, let's think for a moment about how the international community might respond to the idea that one country had been attacked by a cyber war-like activity. One would think under those circumstances, one would ask whether we all ought to now respond with collective penalties against the country that attacked, or if we had a treaty in place that was a cyber treaty, which we don't but should have, whether we would all respond with very severe, consistent sanctions across the world community. That isn't happening in part because we haven't thought through the implications of mutual defense across the world's democracies against those who might want to destabilize them. I suspect that sometime within the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have on the table something that looks very much like a stand-down treaty-based agreement with serious penalties attached to it.
That's so interesting. What would a cyber treaty look like? What would it need to have in it?
Remember that during the Cold War, you know, basically we had all sorts of agreements about how we would respond collectively. NATO is part of that process. So an attack on one is an attack on all. One of the reasons that other countries responded with sanctions against Russia to the poisonings in Britain was that we have a treaty that agrees that that kind of chemical agent isn't going to be used. And if anybody uses it, there's going to be a response across a collective group. So under the treaty notion, you would have all of the nations who signed the treaty and argue that and assert that they would not engage in specified cyber activities. And that would also include not just, you know, intervening in an election, but intervening with an electrical grid, taking down the financial structure of a country. And if any country credibly engages in those activities, all signatories would respond collectively with very severe penalties. And the penalties could be other kinds of cyber responses. They could also be very severe economic sanctions. And our diplomatic community, obviously, which has a lot more expertise in this area than I do, could think through all the other ways that we prevent the initial activity by establishing that the response is going to be so serious that the activity isn't worth the effort and its possible successes.
Would it be useful in any way to return to the Cold War mentality?
I think we need to return to the Cold War mentality, particularly by asking how it is that we prevented the Cold War from becoming a hot war. And we did that in part by dexterous use of treaties. Also, by high levels of sharing of information across allies, and sharing of information from other countries did help the U.S. figure out what was going on with Russia. So some of those pieces were actually in place because of Cold War agreements.
This idea of a cyber treaty, given our current administration and its position in the world, doesn't seem likely anytime soon, as long as the Trump administration is in power.
Doesn't mean that just because some people might not favor it, that it isn't worth having on the table and seriously considering. And the one of the things that I think is important as we ask these questions is that we step away from which party was advantaged and which party disadvantaged to ask, what would we want to do in an ideal universe? Because for practical purposes, the other party could be the one disadvantaged next time. It's not constructive for us to say, well, in the short term, there may be an advantage to this side or that side. It's constructive, I think, in the long term for us to say, let's ask whether we disapprove of this regardless of who benefits and regardless of who's hurt.
If we had a cyber treaty, does that mean social media companies would have to get on board?
Well, there's a second front in the protection that is not one that's based on international agreement. It is self-regulatory moves by the social media entities. And here, we ought to ask, what is it that they can do first to prevent what happened in 2016? So let's go back and try to imagine that we could set things up before 2016 and avert the problem. And one of the things you could do has been done. The platforms are making it more difficult for someone to buy advertising content while someone is a foreign national. Now, doing that's illegal. Foreign nationals can't put money into our electoral system. You know, we've got laws in place that say that's wrong. But now the system is saying it's going to be much more difficult for you to do that because the various platforms have devised different ways, but ways that are preventative, that suggests that before you can buy, you have to establish through, for example, a social security number, a business ID number, or a geolocation where a postcard is sent to a physical place and information on it has to be transmitted back, that you really are able legally to buy content. Now, that's self-regulation, and we need to think of all the ways, short of government interventions, we after all do have a very strong First Amendment that protects free speech, what the platforms can do to increase the likelihood that when someone tries to intervene, they won't be successful and they'll be caught. The other things that are in place, there are many, and many of them are positive. But one is making sure that we know who's talking to us in social media space. So the trolls, the Russian trolls, got away with marauding around, creating high levels of social media activity. 126 million Americans were reached through Facebook content alone because they were able to create anonymized identities. They were able to pretend that they were here rather than there. They were like various groups of us when in fact they were no such thing. So by trying to increase the likelihood that we know who is talking to us across the platforms, there's valuable information there, and we judge source in relationship to content. We don't assess messages without assessing the credibility of the source. So when Google, for example, now discloses the state role in media that are posted online. So when you go to RT content, you don't think RT is just another media source. You know that that's Russian state sponsored. We now have a signal about the content that means that if I read it, I know that I'm reading something the Russians wanted to tell me. Now, maybe I love the Russians and I think that's just fine, or maybe I'm worried about that content and as a result, I'm going to be more wary. So disclosure is a really key protection. The other thing, of course, is the trolls were probably the least efficacious of the factors in our electoral system. They had a lot of content. They were strategically aligned with the Trump objectives. They were visually evocative. They did target to the right constituencies, but we don't know if they reached the right voters in the right places, but the hackers did. The hackers created an impact on our media structures that increased the likelihood throughout the campaign that we heard content and read content that was hostile to Hillary Clinton. And we know how we can prevent the hacking, but that's all that has as one really key component, making sure that all of our systems are as hack-proof as we can make them. And if content is hacked, the major players need to agree not to use it in campaigns. Now, we're coming into 2018. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has said it won't use hacked content. The Republican Congressional Campaign Committee says it doesn't intend to. I wish the Republicans would take that word intend out of that sentence. But in any event, if they will agree not to use it, well, if they get it from a foreign power, they're going to have less impact. And then here's a real weak point. Our press has not indicated to us what its rules are going to be. It rushed content onto the air without scrutinizing it carefully. I argue in Cyber War that at some key places it got the story wrong. And in the process, it subverted our system by taking advantage of our system. And so you have reporters at major news outlets, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the New York Times, who recognize that our reporters and our media outlets were accomplices. They were unwitting accomplices in helping advance the interests of the Kremlin. Well, I'd like to also hear not just we are aware we had a problem, but editors, news platforms, what are you going to do if you get hacked content, say, in 2018 or 2020? Are you going to do something that's different? Are you at least going to make sure that you verify the accuracy of the content before you put it on air? And if you're not, how are you going to warn us? And when the Russian involvement, that is, the Russian hacking, was certified as existing by two of our intelligence agencies or two of our intelligence communities on October 7th, 2016, why didn't the press then, every time it used the hacked content, say to us not it was WikiLeaks, but that it was illegally gotten content by Russian hackers, or that Julian Assange, the person behind WikiLeaks, was distributing the content, and that Julian Assange did not like Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton wanted him prosecuted for Assange's use of classified U.S. military information.
We're speaking with Kathleen Hall Jamison. Her new book is Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. We'll have more with Kathleen in just a moment. And a little bit later on, Ellie Kemper, you've seen her in The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. She'll be here to talk about the Midwest, squirrels, and comedy. For real. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It, and we're back with Kathleen Hall Jamison. Her new book, Cyber War, How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. Now, Kathleen, some people use hackers and trolls interchangeably, and they're not. Could you explain the difference, please?
Hackers are those who enter cyberspace in order to steal content. And what was unprecedented this year, because thefts have occurred before, is they stole it and they released it through three front groups, Guccifer 2, DC Leaks, and then the big player, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's outlet. So the hackers are basically the thieves. The trolls are the ones who are the imposters. They pretend they're someone else. They play games inside our system by putting up fake accounts, by pretending they're people they're not, and by fueling anger, prejudice, and fear as they try to go viral in 2016 with content designed to royal discontent, which would disadvantage the incumbent party, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and also to defeat Hillary Clinton.
Now, were they working in concert or were they working parallel?
We don't know, but we do know that the hackers got access to voter turnout data and basically the Clinton campaign's model of what it needed to do across the country. And if they shared that with the trolls, that is the social media marauders, it would have increased the capacity of the trolls to target the information to those places that they needed to influence to help Donald Trump win the presidency.
And those were the three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
Decided by about 78,000 votes.
I have a question. In terms of the hackers, was this a crime of opportunity? You know, the car door is open and the purse is on the front seat so you can take it. Or was this a case they were out there looking, that they were out there, went out to steal a purse and stole it from someone?
You can't just wander around cyberspace with all of the capacities that are there and just randomly pick and accomplish the objectives of the hackers. This was highly strategic. And interestingly, the day that candidate Trump said, Russia, if you're listening, why don't you try to find those 33,000 emails of Hillary Clinton's? Now, those were emails that Clinton staff members had deleted on the grounds that they were private personal emails, not relevant to her time as Secretary of State and her official roles. But that same day, according to the Mueller indictment of the hackers, the first attempt to hack into the personal office of Hillary Clinton was attempted by the hackers. Now, they didn't succeed, but nonetheless, that's a remarkable coincidence. Were they simply randomly wandering around and they found open doors? No, they were looking for open doors. And as you know, with so-called phishing attacks, you actually are basically throwing some bait out there, trying to get someone inside an organization to open access to let you in. When someone at the Democrat National Committee did that, the Podesta emails were stolen. And those Podesta emails wreaked havoc with the Hillary Clinton campaign throughout the rest of the election, from October 7th, when the first day that they were released, through the election. They not only changed the agenda, the news agenda, when the Access Hollywood tape emerged, by creating a parallel narrative about the Hillary Clinton speeches. Was she really the same in public as in private? Which helped Trump survive that weekend. But they also, throughout the rest of October, punctuated the news agenda with anti-Hillary content. And we see an effect in our surveys that suggested that that may have affected public perception of her qualification for presidency. And the hacked content was used as the basis for questions in the second and third debate that seriously disadvantaged Hillary Clinton.
You mentioned earlier, and you mentioned in the book, about the mainstream media following trends and trending things online and Twitter. Why do you think the mainstream media got played so?
Well, first, the relationship between the trolls and the hackers is not simply the possible transfer of the electoral data from the hackers to the trolls that would have helped the trolls target. We don't know whether it happened, but it's certainly plausible in a centralized state such as Russia. But what we're seeing when we look at the ways in which the trolls work is that by pushing up the uses through liking and sharing of content in social media and getting it to trend, the trolls and their automated accounts, the bots, increase the likelihood that the press, now we're in public space, not in social media space, would see a topic trending and as a result would cover it. And what I show in Cyber War is the ways in which, and this was documented by a very fine other scholar, the deplorables comment by Hillary Clinton was magnified and pushed through social media in ways that increased its trending, which increased the likelihood that it would get coverage in mainstream news.
We've been talking about how they were effective. Were there places where these hackers and trolls were ineffective?
Yes, there's a real difference among the troll accounts. Some of the troll accounts are so fluent in English that reputable conservatives retweeted them. Now, you can't assume that a reputable conservative is going to retweet something thinking it's suspect content. So the fluency was there. But there are other accounts in which the use of English language strongly suggests that the person who's writing is not thinking in English. And then within those odd phrasings, you see indications that the person is thinking in Russian. Specifically, you see the suppression of the definite and indefinite article. But those kinds of content could nonetheless be effective. And I looked at some that were, that is, some that were widely shared. And what made them effective was the evocative visual and the use of print overlaid on the evocative visual. Then when you get into the text below, you're noticing, oh, the indefinite article isn't there. Most people probably liked and shared and did not read the rest of what they saw on the page.
So they really went, the visual seems to be where they were most effective.
The visuals are extraordinarily powerful, and I include a number of them in the book.
Some of them are incredible, really. I mean,
and some of them are far too vulgar for us to discuss on air. But nonetheless, if you had to say, how do we act when we're sharing and liking? First, sharing and liking increase the likelihood that we think our community endorses content. So by increasing sharing and liking, the trolls increase the likelihood that we would see this content as content that people like us agree with. That creates an effect. It increases the likelihood we will talk about it with others, hence an impact outside social media in our real world lives. But secondly, it increases the likelihood that those who are inside the community begin to dominate the talk in their community, and those who oppose that kind of content fall to the wayside. So it increases what is called a spiral of silence effect. The notion that it's the norm to believe this, it's the outlier not to believe it, increases talk about it, but reduces talk against it. So those are really powerful kinds of effects. And by liking and sharing and using bots to create the illusion that content was being liked and shared, we increase the likelihood that when we see it, the visually evocative content with words superimposed, we simply like and share. We don't bother to read, examine, and critically scrutinize. We also are less likely to critically scrutinize because these are people inside our community. They are part of us, an insider like-minded community. We don't, of course, know that we've just liked and shared something created by a person in St. Petersburg who 2 hours later will be pretending to be somebody else in a completely different community.
We're speaking with Kathleen Hall Jamieson. The name of her book is Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect the President. And Kathleen, you know, people would say, there are some people who would say that the title of your book is wrong. It didn't happen. It is not true.
Well, the book has as its subtitle, What We Know, Don't Know, Can't Know. And they're probably going to lodge their objections out of what we can't know to say that I don't know with enough certainty to make the case. So what I want to make clear is I'm not arguing that we know categorically with ironclad certainty that the Russians affected the outcome. I argued the preponderance of the evidence suggests that, in fact, that's what occurred. And I make the case based on evidence, and I think people who object need to look at the evidence and say, here's where she's wrong, and here's where I know we're right. Here's my counter evidence.
Before I let you go, what is the biggest misconception about the Russian interference in 2016?
The biggest misconception about the Russian interference is that it was limited to one area and did not cross multiple other areas. So the people who talk about it as being on Facebook, unaware that it was on most of the other social media platforms as well. They'll say, well, it was just the trolls, and the trolls couldn't have affected the outcome. They're not focusing on the fact that the hacked content in news would not have been in news had it been for the hackers. And then I make the argument in the book, Russian disinformation may have influenced James Comey, director of the FBI, to make public the fact that he'd reopened the server investigation about Hillary Clinton because of the information on the Wiener laptop. If that argument is correct, the strength of my case goes way up, because in that period of that investigation's being covered for 9 days of news in the last days of the election, Hillary Clinton dropped in the national polls 2.5 points. Those 2.5 points not only would have swung the key three last states, they would have swung two more as well.
Cyber War: How Russian Hackers and Trolls Helped Elect a President. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, thank you so much for being on All of It.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Ellie Kemper has mastered playing a certain kind of chipper, optimistic extrovert, the kind of person who might earn the wrath of New Yorkers in a rush hour subway car. You know her as Erin on NBC's The Office, Becca in the film Bridesmaids, but most recently she has been shining in the sometimes twisted, sometimes dark, snort-laugh-funny Netflix original series The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, where she plays a woman who was kidnapped and imprisoned in a bunker before being released, and now is just trying to make it in New York with pluck and smile on her face. She's been nominated twice for an Emmy in this role. Ellie Kemper's also a writer writer. Her work has appeared in GQ, Esquire, The New York Times, and McSweeney's. And she's just released a book called My Squirrel Days. And we're so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So one of the things that's so fun about the contents of the book, it's all things you are. So there's like redhead, daughter, actress, Hulk, that's when you get hangry.
Yes.
Right? When you don't eat.
We've all been there.
American, slob, diva, mom. But chapter 3 is where it says squirrel.
Yes.
In the third chapter, you share a story about you and a kind of Zoftig squirrel.
Yes.
You call her Natalie. What was your relationship with Natalie?
My relationship was that I was desperately attempting to become a friend to this squirrel. And I had just seen Dances with Wolves. I was inspired by the idea of trying to commune with nature and be one with nature. And so I took it upon myself to go out and be the person I wanted to be by treating the squirrel as I would any friend. Natalie had no interest in being my friend for some reason. I don't know why. A pale, you know, large-faced redhead, but it had no interest. And it, you know, I realized just how indifferent nature can be when I fell off a tree and Natalie laughed at me.
I want you to read this paragraph.
Oh,
Natalie's
fantastic
reaction when you fall
yes,
off the tree.
Yes, yes, this yes. one right here. I turned to look and there was Natalie, an unearthly sound coming from her open mouth. It wasn't quite a scream, but it wasn't a cackle either. It was a shrill cry that reminded me of David Bowie's character from Labyrinth. Was Natalie laughing at me? Whatever she was doing, it seemed to be coming not from a place of fellowship, but of barbarity. Who was this unrecognizable brute laughing in the face of my pain? I stared at Natalie, hurt and bewildered. This only seemed to make her laugh harder. I shook my head, tears welling in my eyes, unable to understand any of it. Dramatic.
It is. Why was it important to include Natalie in your squirrel days as you tell your life story?
Because I feel like that was, I'm trying to be funny about it, but I do think it was sort of a crucial step in becoming, in growing up, in realizing, you know, you're going to forge friendships and you're figuring out exactly who you are. And at that moment in particular, I think I was trying to figure out who I was based on a lot of movies I had seen mm-hmm. and drawing, you know, different traits and just trying to find an identity, as everyone does.
Improviser is one of the titles, and you know you cut your teeth like a lot of young comedians in New York. You were at UCB, and you had an SNL audition. Why did you decide to gravitate towards improvisation versus stand-up?
Because I would be a terrible stand-up. I think that the two modes of comedy could not be more different. I think stand-up is jokes and your I think it's more individual. And what I love about and I could never do it. And what I love about improv is that it the very definition of improv is that you are performing with other people, and so you are trying to serve the ensemble. And it first, I don't feel as much pressure in that situation, and you are creating something as a whole unit, which I love. And I will get corny. I do think it's a great kind of model for how we should all behave in the world, because its central tenet is yes and, which
right.
is that you take what your scene partner gives you and then you heighten it. And that's something I think that's very valuable.
And how do you use that in your work now as an actress?
I think I could be working in any business and use that sort of mentality in my work, which is to accept what is thrown at you and mm-hmm. make the best of it. And, you know, on The Office, where I played Erin Hannon for a few years, we improvised a little bit, not a ton, but enough to mention that we improvised it. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is so tightly written and the jokes are so sharp and pristine and brilliant. There's no improvisation there. And I like both styles. I think that they both have their merits.
Now, you had an SNL audition. That seems to be sort of a rite of passage of young,
yeah.
talented, funny people in New York. How did it go?
Not well. I'm not on it. That's fine. I forgot all about it. I
you know who has an issue with it? Have you ever listened to Mark Maron?
No.
It comes up like every 3 months about his SNL audition. It's one of my favorite things about him.
Did.
He's doing great. Can't let it go.
No, understood. Although in my I like, there's a reason Lorne Michaels is Lorne Michaels. I mean, I wouldn't have thrived in that environment. I can't do celebrity impressions. My face sort of looks like Renee Zellweger, so that was one of my mm-hmm. Impressions for my audition. And I think the other was Miley Cyrus. But no, I auditioned. I want to say that room, everyone says, oh, the room is so cold and everyone's so scary. Everyone I met there was totally warm. People laughed. I have fond memories of my failed audition.
Well, I always say, you know, two of the people who didn't do well on Saturday Night Live are Robert Downey Jr. and Julia Dreyfus. So So you're in good company.
If my name is anywhere close to Julia Louis-Dreyfus, I'm thrilled.
We're speaking with Ellie Kemper about her new book, My Squirrel Days. Kimmy is one of your chapters, obviously, because you've had this huge success with Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. When you first heard this pitch, okay, she's a lady who was in a bunker and she was a mole person, and then she comes out and goes to New York and wears bright pink pants and sort of wants it. She's sort of that girl in a weird way.
Yeah, exactly right. No, I think that so Robert Carlock and Tina Fey created the show, and it was originally going to be on NBC. And when you hear that premise, to me, NBC sitcom doesn't immediately spring to mind. But these two are geniuses. They, of course, Tina created 30 Rock and Robert was one of the showrunners. And they managed to make this incredibly dark premise into a hilarious show. I mean, it's a bright, uplifting, optimistic show. Very helpful during these times. And and I think that it doesn't shy away from the dark moments. It sort of embraces them. And the show is all about moving forward. And in the that girl vein, it is a fish out of water story. It's heightened circumstances, but it's a large faced rube starting over in New York City, as so many of us have.
And it's so funny because it also is sort of a weird love letter to New York.
Yes.
And all the weird things about living in New York and gentrification and living in an apartment that shouldn't be an apartment.
All of it. Titus, I think, has one line. He's like, something about his outfit, a shirt he found on a fence. I love that. That's what he's wearing.
So you're talking about the yes and you're part of an ensemble, but there's no Kimmy Schmidt without Kimmy and without you. This show really hangs on you. When you first got the role, you must have been excited, but then what did you think about that idea of it's me, all the time?
Well, it is, yes. Luckily, the ensemble is like the strongest cast you'll ever meet, and the characters are so dynamic and brilliant, and the people playing them are equally so. It was a switch for me because I was, 18 on the call sheet as Erin Hannon, which is like the, piece of paper you get on a film production. I was 18, and then you go and you're number one, and that was a huge shift. But also, pathetically enough, I felt like, I'm not cut out for this. Can I handle the workload? And being an actor on a television show is, for me to consider that hard. I obviously haven't done too many hard things because you get to take naps during the day. I mean, any job where you can take a nap isn't going to be.
And they bring food to you on a table.
And it's endless.
Available.
Available food you would never eat normally. Malamars and, cheese doodle. You're not, although maybe, I don't know. You're not usually eating that at 9 in the morning, but you have that brought to you. So I did, but the hours, it was an adjustment, and it was more fun saying lines than sitting in the background. I will say that.
Now, you got to work with Tina Fey, and I think for any woman in comedy or any woman writer, period, she's such an amazing role model and example. What did you learn about writing, because you are clearly a writer, from Tina Fey?
Oh, well, so I was never in the writer's room on the show Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, but I have read Bossy Pants probably 14 times. I love that book, and I'm not comparing our books in any way. I think that what I've learned about writing from her is probably just watching all of the shows that she's written and reading all of the prose that she's written. She is, I think, unmatched, and her jokes are so sharp. And if I get an email from her, I'll be like, how did she just come up with that? Like, it'll be some funny line just rattled off. And yeah, I don't know if I learned anything. I've just absorbed. I hope, I don't know. I just am honored to be in her presence.
You've been nominated twice for an Emmy for Best Actress in a Comedy for this. And in your book, you talk about what it's like to actually have to attend one of these award shows. And, as your mom said, you have the best job ever, but that's a whole thing. Like, it's a whole process. It's when you said you want your blood level to be 70% kale
right.
The 2 days before.
I know.
What is that really? I mean, you seem like a very normal, great, nice person. What is it like to be dropped into that world?
Well, again, it's the most privileged form of humiliation I think you can feel, because you it's high school all over again, and everyone is just trying. People act like they're having a good time. I don't know if anyone's actually having a good time, because these are not real problems anyone is having. But at the same time, it's the most enormous problem you could ever have, because you start to feel like, it's a fashion show. I don't know. The whole thing can be stressful in a very silly way. But my whole thing is that nobody really ever knows who I am. Like, when you're on the red carpet, you the photographers go crazy, as they should, over, Jessica Biel and Kristen Bell and everybody. And then I go, I feel like I want to hold, some sort of placard or something that says my name so that at least they'll know who I am. But it's an honor to be at those shows.
Can you just tell them the story about your giant bangs?
I don't know what happened. So the cast of Bridesmaids got to present an award at, I think, the 2011 or 12 Oscars, which is unbelievable. And for some reason, I had this like long mane, this fringe going, bangs. And I don't know why I didn't think about cutting them before appearing on stage at the Oscars, but I didn't. And they were cutting off about like the top half of my eye, so I couldn't totally see everything happening that night. And that was a decision I'm still wondering about. They also, my bangs started like at the back of my head. They were very long bangs. And was that a look anyone was doing besides me?
I don't know. You know, it's, the picture is fantastic because you can tell you're just like, I'm going to smile.
I'm smiling.
I can't really see anybody. I'm going to assume
gonna
I look good.
Do it.
Talking to Ellie Kemper. You also talked with award shows. One of my favorite moments of you at an award show was at the SAG Awards, because they have these really sort of earnest intros at the SAG Awards. I'm an actor and it allows me to be able to have my craft and to speak my truth. And then they come to you and you say this.
6 months ago, I gave birth to a beautiful baby boy, and he gave me my greatest role yet, the role of mom. I'm kidding. My greatest role is playing Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix. That's what got me to free dinner. Sorry, James. I'm Ellie Kemper, and I'm Netflix.
I'm like gonna cry. Sorry, James. He was only 6 months old.
Yeah. Sorry, James. And the best part of it is the people behind you are like, when you're saying mom, they're like, oh. And then their faces all just sort of change and then laugh. Tell me about James.
James is a wonder. I mean, I have absolutely fallen into the long line of people who just think that their baby is the most extraordinary baby that ever was. In my case, James actually is the most extraordinary baby that ever was. It's incredible. He's brilliant, very athletic, very funny. And the most of any baby. But it changes everything, right? You think that you can anticipate what's going to change, and you are aware that things will change, but you don't. I don't think you can understand it until you're in it. But he just turned 2. I think he still has a little bit of red hair. I mean, it's in the sun. It's red. But I am. He's like very funny. Okay, I just want to tell you a joke he said.
Sure. Sorry.
So we've been reading Paddington, and Paddington the bear is from Darkest Peru. And James lately thinks it's funny to say that he used to live in Darkest Poo, which is so funny to
that
me.
Is very funny.
I mean, that he's the funniest baby.
Oh, my son used to call false eyelashes eyelash wigs.
But which they are.
It's accurate.
Brilliant. Stock, the smartest info. Yeah.
He calls tights leg socks.
See, but that again, like. I mean, again, this sounds cliched, but they are able to open our eyes, because that's what they are, leg socks.
Leg socks.
And the way they put things together is unbelievable. I don't know. I cry at everything now. I mean, you're so right. You're so much more sensitive. Your son's how old?
He's 10 now, yeah. So I don't cry as much. Yeah. I'm just sort of interested in your background, because I know a lot of people in St. Louis, right? So I know what Ledoux is. Ledoux is kind of like the Montclair of St. Louis.
Yes.
And you played field hockey.
Yeah.
You're pretty fierce. You went to Princeton. You have a resume that sounds like you might be a chief marketing officer or like a corporate lawyer. What made you go into acting, and what did your parents think when you sort of had this trajectory of like academic overachiever?
Right. Yes. Okay. So first of all, it was demoralizing the first few years I was in New York, because a lot of my classmates were doing were pursuing jobs that you just mentioned, sort of, I think, very ambitious jobs where you can very concretely measure success. And I felt like such a schlub, because I would invite them to my improv shows, which they would very kindly attend. And, you know, but you sort of say, you mention your work and you feel like an idiot because your work is improvising at Champion Studio for 3 hours. And that feels, I don't know. Is this concrete? Is this what? So that was, it was hard to understand that the work you're doing is work, and you have to consider it as work if you are to move forward with it. So that was a lesson that I took a while for me to learn. But my parents are so supportive. We have 3 siblings, and they are so supportive of all of us. I was lucky to have not only their emotional support, but at the very beginning, and I want to be open about that, I was able to lean on them for financial help, and that was a huge advantage I had. But I think that in terms I don't think that my parents had any idea in their heads about what any of their kids should pursue, so long as it's something that is challenging, I think, and invigorating. I'm not sure they would use the word invigorating. Ellie, I want you to find a career that's invigorating.
That's lovely, though. Yeah. You were just at Princeton recently for the She Roars.
Yes.
Tell us about this. It was this weekend, right?
It was this past weekend. I spoke on Saturday night. I am on a high. I don't know what. First of all, this convention, it was a reunion sort of over 3,000 women who went back to Princeton to celebrate feminism and women in all its forms. And it couldn't have come at a better time, quite frankly. And I'm on a complete high. I feel like roaring all week long, which I'm going to. But I got to give a speech, some remarks at this dinner on Saturday evening. And the whole audience was roaring. It was very cathartic. It was just lovely. The Justices Kagan and Sotomayor spoke on Friday evening. And of course, we weren't allowed anywhere near them. But hearing them speak was a balm. It was very calming. It was reassuring.
It was the next. That's so great when you get in a room like that and you sort of remember who you were also as a young person, a young woman, and then taking everything you know now.
That's exactly right. And returning there, like, you know, they call it the dinky, the train.
A little train, yeah.
Yeah, a little train from Princeton Junction to Princeton. You feel like you're going back to the womb. But you're a woman now. You're a woman re-entering the womb. I'll leave it at that.
When you look back, what do you think your big break was?
Definitely getting cast as Erin Hannon on The Office.
That was it. That was the watershed thing.
For sure. And that was you know, as most of these things are, a combination of good timing, good luck, and that Mike Schur and Greg Daniels cast me along with Allison Jones. So very grateful. Very grateful to them.
What are you going to do next?
I don't know.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Yeah.
What do you want to do next?
That's the question. That's what I'm trying to figure out right now. Whenever there's like whenever one job ends and Kimmy will we'll stream the final episodes in January, so our show is officially done, although we might be doing a movie. I don't know. Yes, I'm not sure if that's finalized yet, but I am trying to figure, you know, it's different now than it ever has been for me personally, because I didn't have a son before when switching jobs. So, you know, taking other people into account is this new and wild thing for me. I don't know if I like it. No, it'll be good.
Ellie Kemper, the book's really enjoyable, and I swear, you did write this. There was no ghostwriter.
There were
no
ghostwriters. I wrote it. Thank you.
Ellie Kemper, My Squirrel Days. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after a break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Do you remember back in late August when a swarm of bees took over the umbrella of an unsuspecting food cart in Times Square? Video of the bees went viral, and many people learned that day not only does the NYPD have a resident beekeeper, you can check out the Twitter account, but that bees are just as much a part of the city as we all are. One of the more unlikely places that bees thrive in New York City is on the roof of the Waldorf Astoria, which piqued the interest of naturalist Leslie Day, who heard about the beehive through a family connection years ago. Day teaches at the New York Botanical Garden, and her latest book is Honeybee Hotel, the Waldorf Astoria's Rooftop Garden and the Heart of NYC. Nice to see you, Leslie.
Thank you for having me.
So your book is great because it's also a history of the Waldorf Astoria, we learned. Can you give us a little bit of background? When did that start, and why did the Astor family want a rooftop garden?
Well, you have to go back about 250 years to John Jacob Astor, who arrived here right after the American Revolution. He was a poor man, but he was a brilliant man, and he wanted to make a lot of money, and he got into the fur trade, which sold beaver pelts to the Europeans. He became a multimillionaire from that, and then he bought up as much of Manhattan real estate as he could. Over the years, his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren made about hundreds of millions of dollars from that, and they went into the hotel business. And his great-grandson, William Waldorf Astor, who lived on the corner of 33rd and 5th, and his other great-grandson, John Jacob Astor IV, lived on the corner of 34th and 5th, and they couldn't stand each other. There was a garden between them, and one of the writers said, a sea of turgidity between them. And William Waldorf Astor sold his house and built the Waldorf Hotel, and he moved his family to England. And then John Jacob Astor convinced his mother, Lena Schermerhorn Astor, the head of the 400 families of the Gilded Age, to build the Astoria Hotel. And they connected the Waldorf and the Astoria with this alleyway called Peacock Alley. And it became a gilded, mirrored hall where thousands of people walked through every day in their finery and looked at each other. And it was named by a journalist Peacock Alley. They put up a roof garden. And then in the winter, where their guests could sit outside on hot summer nights, and in the winter, they froze it so people could ice skate on it.
Oh, so romantic.
And then in 1929, right before the Great Depression hit, they decided to move the hotel uptown because the wealthy people were moving uptown. So they tore down the hotel, and the Empire State Building rose on that corner. On that block. Mm. And the new hotel went up in 1931, opened in 1932. And they had the starlight roof and they had terraces, but they didn't really have a garden at the new hotel. It wasn't until the executive chef David Garcelone, who was from Toronto, came to the hotel in 2010, and he had put beehives on the hotel in Toronto, the Fairmont Royal York, another very fancy hotel that had a garden. But when he came to New York, they wanted him to do the same thing. And so he got in touch with Andrew Cote, the head of the New York City Beekeepers Association, and with George Pesegna, the head of the New York Horticultural Society. And those two organizations helped him, taught them how to build beehives, how to plant the garden, how to take care of it. And what I found out, what was so interesting to me, was that the New York Horticultural Society has this greenhouse program on Rikers Island where they train detainees who want to learn about horticulture how to take care of plants. It's the most wonderful program. Mm-hmm. And then once the people leave Rikers Island, if they want to continue with horticulture, the HORT, the New York Horticultural Society, continues to train them. And they were the people who took care of the plants on the roof of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel.
Now, but I have to break in for a second, because initially when David Garcelone wanted to bring bees on, there were a couple people who weren't on board. The chief engineer, they were concerned about bees in the hotel,
well,
right?
The hotel had the insurance company look into it, and they realized that honeybees are not like wasps and not going to go into a can of soda or flowers inside your room, that honeybees are there at the garden to do one thing, and that is to collect nectar from the flowers and to collect pollen from the flowers and bring it back to the hive to feed their babies and to feed themselves. And so he got the okay.
The names of the hives are fantastic. Can you share some of the names of the hives?
Yeah, they had a competition. There were six hives, which the hotel workers built. That was another thing that really struck me, was that here are these people coming in on their days off to build the hives, to build the raised garden beds as volunteers. They were so interested in this. It meant so much to them. So there, my favorite was, it's 5 o'clock somewhere in the world, the Presidential Suite, Empire Hive of Mind, the Royal Suite. I can't remember all of them.
They're so great. And the honey that the bees produce, is it actually served at the Waldorf?
The honey was served, you know, the Waldorf has closed. It's not, it'll be closed for another 3 years.
I didn't realize it was
so closed. Yeah. The Chinese insurance company, Anbang Insurance, bought the hotel from Hilton for $2 billion. It's been closed now for almost a couple of years. And they said, I just read an article, they're reopening in 2021. The hives were taken care of by the beekeeper, but also by the chefs. And since they closed down the hotel, the hives have been moved to the Hilton on 6th Avenue and 56th Street. And Andrew Cote still takes care of them.
That's so great. So the hives are fine.
The hives are fine. The bees are alive. And hopefully, I mean, I'm hoping this book will do something to encourage the new owners to put the garden back and to put the bees back. Because the whole point of writing this story was to show all these different caring communities coming together. And so you have the chefs who take care of the bees and take care of their garden and then share the produce and the honey from the hives with the homeless shelter at St. Bartholomew's Church across the street. And then you have the Crossroads Community, a charitable wing of St. Bart's that has a homeless shelter for 10 women who live there every night and feed breakfast to 150 people every morning and have a food pantry that serves 1,000 people every month. And then you have the bees themselves within their hives taking care of their thousands of babies and each other and their queen, really literally working themselves to death, taking care of each other. And then at the end, when they were going to close the Waldorf, it was noted in the Wall Street Journal that they might gut the hotel. And that set all of the city's conservation, preservation associations into action to protect the hotel and all of its Art Deco and gorgeous interiors.
It's beautiful.
So this is not just a story about bees.
This is
a story about community.
This is a story about community. You know, the hotels, and most hotels, the kitchens are run by immigrants. And the bees themselves are immigrants. They're European honeybees. And so you have all these people working together, caring about each other, and making each other feel safe.
The name of the book is Honeybee Hotel, The Waldorf Astoria's Rooftop Garden in the Heart of New York City. It's lovely. It's got beautiful pictures. Leslie Day, thank you so much for joining us on All of Us. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will be right back after the news.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.